This is part three of the story Misguided Directions. When she and George had left Newark, they had declared that except for visits to family and some of the really good meat markets and bakeries, there was no reason for them to return to the city. And yet she had been driving its streets every day for weeks. The librarian smiled when she saw Marjorie. The woman had become such a fixture at the microfilm machine that she missed seeing her there in the last few days. The librarian looked down at her watch. There really wasn't enough time left in the day to start the lengthy kind of work that Marjorie did, but she would assist as much as she could. Did you have any luck with the Hall of Records? Marjorie smiled sadly. I don't seem to have very much luck at all. The librarian glanced at her watch for Marjorie's benefit and said, Is there something that I can get for you? We are going to be closing shortly. Without thinking, Marjorie blurted, Do you know anything about the Jewish community of Newark? What is it that you're interested in? That kind of information would probably be located in the New Jersey Historical Section. I don't think that's the kind of thing that I need, said Marjorie. The tone of defeat in her voice touched the librarian, who watched her struggle to learn how to use the machine and then sit for hours in a neck-stiffening position, scanning through issue after issue of forgotten newspapers. The only thing that I know is when they left without a trace. When they left, Marjorie picked up her head for the first time. Well, you know how it is with this city. Most of the good people pulled out a long time ago. Marjorie's face brightened. She thanked the librarian for all of her kindness and shook her hand. Then she hurried to her car. When they left, that was it. Her father's family had left the city. Probably they hadn't gone too far. She hadn't gone too far. They could be in West Orange, Verona, or Livingston. When she got home, Marjorie went straight for her suburban Essex phone book. There were three pages dedicated to the name Bernstein. She began to make the calls. When George came home and found his wife still sitting at the table with an open phone book, he had to try to stop her. Marjorie, I know how much this means to you, but don't you see what you were doing? You're closing yourself off from everything around you. It's almost as if you were the person that disappeared. Marjorie felt punched in the stomach by the last sentence. I'm doing what I think I have to do, George. Then she began to dial the next number, but her hands were shaking. Then she heard the voice inside her head that always preceded one of her spells. What do you think you're doing? Something very bad is going to happen, and it's all going to be your fault because you won't give up on this foolishness. Marjorie put the phone down. She felt like she was going to pass out. There was a tightness in her throat. She began to gasp for air. Her mind was out of control. Had she already done the thing that was going to cause the awful things to happen? She lit a cigarette and took a Librium. She needed to calm down. She peered out of the window into the room that George had retreated off to. It seemed very far away and dangerous. She was sure that she couldn't make herself go that far. My God, what's happening to me? She said. She was actually afraid to leave the kitchen and go into her own living room. She was afraid to get up from the table. She was afraid to speak. She was afraid to breathe. When Dr. Bork answered his phone, he could barely make out Marjorie's voice whispering on the other end of the line. Dr. Bork, something very bad is happening to me. and I need to see you. Could I please come over? Bork heard the distress. He had almost expected that something like this would happen sooner or later. Can you come over right now? Yes, said Marjorie. Thank you so much. She put down the phone and looked back into the living room. It was still so very far away. The door was on the other side of the room, and beyond the door was nothing that she knew. She got up slowly and moved from the back of the chair to the counter. Her legs felt heavy. She moved to the doorway. She was beginning to sweat. George, she called. There was no answer. Then she heard the shower running from the upstairs bathroom. He was ready to go out, she thought. She moved back to the phone and dialed her son's number. There was no answer. She was crying when she put the phone down. He was never there when she needed him anymore. Then she had an idea. If she called a cab, she would be able to go. She would know what was waiting for her outside the door. She could picture the cab in her mind, and she made her way back through the living room. She had got to Dr. Bork's office by cab before. Yes, she could do that. 3. Marjorie, it's good to see you again. Dr. Bork extended his hand and guided the patient into his foyer. Dr. Bork, I'm terribly sorry to be bothering you like this. I don't know what came over me. Why don't we just go into my office and talk about it, said Bork. When Marjorie looked around, she saw that the office still gave her a secure feeling. Her breathing had returned to normal, and she no longer felt like she was going to faint. How have you been doing, Marjorie? She recounted the story of her search, and then she told him about the argument with George and the effect that it had on her. When she was finished, she was sitting stiffly, waiting to hear what he would have to say. She expected him to admonish her for going overboard, but he didn't say anything. He filled his pipe and lit it with a long wooden match. Doctor, do you think that I'm having a breakdown? Dr. Bork tipped back in his chair and smiled. What I think you are having is a breakthrough, Marjorie. What do you mean? What I've heard is not the story of a woman who was unable to go to the Grand Union. I've been listening to the amazing story of a persistent survivor who had let her determination and instincts lead her towards what she thought was right in the face of overwhelming odds. But Dr. Bork, I wasn't even able to walk into my parlor tonight. You got yourself here when you needed to, though, didn't you? I took a cab. But you did what was necessary for you to get what you needed for yourself. Don't you see? That is one of the truly important things that happened to you tonight. Your son wasn't there to help you. Your husband wasn't there to help you. Your aunt is no longer alive. And still, you were able to get yourself here. But what happened to me? I can't tell for sure. But I can tell you what I think is going to happen. I think that George inadvertently enunciated one of your deepest subconscious fears, the fear that somehow you would disappear too. Marjorie felt another jolt inside of her, even at the mere mention of the words. Bork noticed her stiffen and saw that her face looked panicked. I think this is still difficult for you to hear me say those words. The truth is, however, that you're here because you want to be here. Look at your past, Marjorie. Your grandmother was always afraid to let you do anything because of what she'd seen happen to her own children. She was determined to make sure that you weren't lost to her as well. What she did in order to accomplish that was to try to scare you to death about the outside world. She didn't do it as an act of meanness. It was out of fear. Your aunts went along with her, probably out of guilt that they felt about what they'd done with their own lives. This search that you say has haunted you has probably given you the strength to attempt things that you had felt never able to do otherwise. Don't you realize how incredible it is that a young girl would have the gumption to go to a prison and then later meet with a convicted murderer? Your story around the last few weeks in the library is simply amazing. Of course the librarian wanted to help you. You are someone who is worthy of being helped. The medicine of praise was having a tremendously restorative effect on Marjorie. Do you think that I'll ever find out what happened to my father? I don't know, but I'm sure that somewhere along the way, you will discover an appreciation of yourself. I feel like I'm at a dead end. You've felt that way before. I seem to keep going back to old newspapers. Perhaps you should try a more contemporary approach. I don't know what you mean. Perhaps the person who could help you is still out there to be found. Then Marjorie understood what Bork was talking about. 1 year later, in the Sunday edition of the Star Ledger, the following letter appeared in the editorial section under the subhead, "Search Runs Into Stonewall." Dear Editor, I have been trying to obtain a death certificate from my father for the last several years now, to no avail. These are the reasons. I started going and writing to all of the Department of Health offices for each county in New Jersey to ask to search through their records. Each time that I have researched has cost me the $4. At the time of my father's presumed death, July 3rd, 1930, he used aliases, so it has therefore cost me several hundred dollars, and I have still found no evidence of a death certificate. I have contacted the Department of Vital Statistics in Trenton on several occasions, and the state registrar refuses me admissions to check the records for 1930 in July. He claims that all such records are closed to the public. I have explained to him that the reason that I wish to be allowed to look myself is that I am more likely to recognize the alias. Also, in the last year, I have been in contact with the United States Department of Justice, the Census Bureau, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the United States Department of Defense, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Letter Forwarding Service of the Bureau of Data Processing, the United States Department of Commerce, the United States House of Representatives, the Social Security Administration, the United States Army, and the United States Navy. Additionally, I have searched the death records for the states of New York and Pennsylvania. I would ask at this time that someone come forward and attempt to be of assistance to me. I am not willing to give up the search to discover the fate of my father. But if there is anyone who can give me information relating to the life of Larry Bernstein of Newark, New Jersey, please contact the editor of this newspaper, and he can put you in touch with me. Sincerely, Marjorie Bombasco, Bloomfield, New Jersey. When the family location and legal services agent contacted Marjorie some 3 days later, she was genuinely surprised. The letter to the editor had been her final idea. Tracing the family name through the synagogue records for the temple, which had been located in Marjorie's old neighborhood, the representative found the Bernstein family living two towns away from Marjorie. On a cool April evening, Marjorie had her first conversation with a member of her father's family. The woman's name was Stephanie Weiss. After being contacted by her rabbi, Mrs. Weiss agreed to speak with Marjorie. "Mrs. Weiss, do you know what happened to my father?" "Mrs. Bombasco, I agreed to speak with you at the urging of Rabbi Feldman, but I must tell you that I have no reason to believe that my Uncle Larry was ever married or ever had a child." "How old is your uncle now?" said Marjorie, holding her breath. "Well, if he were still alive, he would be in his 70s, I would imagine." "What happened to him?" "Something very bad, I think. We were never allowed to talk about him as children. I think he did something very wrong. Anyway, I know that my father and my grandfather arranged for him to be brought back to Poland right around 1931 or so." "Then what happened?" said Marjorie. There was a pause on the other end of the line. "You know what happened in Poland, don't you?" Then Marjorie began to tell the story of her life and her search. The woman was astonished. "I do remember some talk of Larry being involved with a Gentile girl, but I never heard her name mentioned. I do have a brother who might know more about it. He was older than me, you know. Would you mind giving me his number?" "I don't think that I should do that, but I would be willing to call him and tell him about you. I'll get back to you in a short while." That night, Marjorie waited for the return call, but it never came. She waited by the phone through the next day and the next. Then she called Stephanie Weiss back. The woman seemed very frightened. "My brother was upset with me when I called him. He has refused to do anything with you and with this. What happened was all so very long ago, my dear, and I just don't know how I can help you. Those were very bad times that everyone would like to forget." Marjorie pleaded, but the woman excused herself and hung up. Was there another lie? What was there to do now? 1 week later, Marjorie's old friend, the librarian, smiled when she saw her standing at her desk with a request form. Marjorie returned the smile and asked, "Could you please direct me to a section that would contain information about the Holocaust?"